Wake Up with Bill Finch is live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut. Speak your mind. 203-333-9422.
And wake up, everybody, here in Connecticut on the Voice of Connecticut. So happy that you joined us this morning on National Pizza Day. And we're the pizza and basketball capital of the world, supposedly. So let's celebrate. What better way to celebrate than to talk about our wonderful state government and all the wonderful things it does at the hands of really great leaders. I'm very pleased this morning to be joined by Senator Kathy Osten, who is a senator from Eastern Connecticut. And you wonder, why the heck would Connecticut down here in Fairfield County want to know about Eastern Connecticut? Well, let me just tell you, it's the fastest growing part of Connecticut. It has our sub base. It has our casinos. It has UConn Avery Point. And it has Senator Kathy Osten. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. How are you, Bill?
Well, I'm really wide awake because I've been shoveling for the last couple hours and enjoying the New England weather. I always get a kick out of people who complain, and don't get involved. And then they move to Florida. And as soon as they get sick of Florida, they're back to Connecticut. So we love Connecticut, right, Kath?
Absolutely. And Connecticut is just the best in so many things, not only education, healthcare, and, of course, we have Electric Boat, the sub-base, the two federally recognized tribal nations and their businesses of the casino. And I hope you all want to take a ride up here. I've already been out and about myself.
Well, listen, we're really happy that you're here today, but obviously our country's in a bit of a meltdown with a constitutional crisis where the people who make the budget in Washington are being circumvented. They're being locked out of federal agencies. It's basically a king's court, a royalty that we've got in Washington, with the court being the wealthiest people in the world, the oligarchs. And they're taking over our government. It's a sad thing to see, but how refreshing is it, Kath, that we could be listening to our governor, who is not going around the legislature, who's respecting the balance of power between the legislature, the two houses of the legislature, and the governor, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. All is right in Connecticut. We're joined by Brett Brosder, also from Washington, D.C., our man in Washington. Good morning, Brett.
Hey, Mayor. Hey, Senator. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I would like to answer that question by saying we in Connecticut are much better than the rest of the country, where usurpation of the legislative process is underway, and we're seeing our government dismantled right before our eyes, but not here in Connecticut. And the reason why it's so important to have Senator Osten on this morning, Brett, and you to maybe ask a couple questions is we have a wonderful deliberative process. It's messy. It's a human institution. It's a meat grinder, but at the end, we have a budget that meets the needs of the residents who pay the taxes, right? Right, Senator?
Absolutely. In Connecticut, we work well with each other. We respect each other's ideas, and we're more than happy to have a debate on what is important for Connecticut residents.
You know, in full disclosure, and obviously you both know this, I'm a registered lobbyist, and I represent the electrical contractors as well as the union that they hire from those union halls. And one of the things I've noticed this year is that, not to contradict what you've said, Senator, but we have seen quite an uptick in the anti-union legislation, whether that's coming generically from the members or from their think tank, ALEC, we don't really know, but there seems to be the prevailing wage limit in Connecticut is the highest of any state with its own prevailing wage law, meaning that $1 million of work has to happen before we pay a living prevailing wage to the workers. The next highest state is Maryland, and we'd like to see it reduced to the $250,000 in the state of Maryland, the next highest in the United States, so we would still be the highest prevailing wage threshold. But we actually have Republicans putting in elimination of the prevailing wage or having the prevailing wage limit go up so that people don't make enough take-home pay to pay the rent and the car payment. So we've seen that, and I wonder whether or not you see this as maybe a little bit of a a whittling away of the great bipartisanship we've had in Connecticut for the last 200 to 300 years?
So I don't know, because I've been in the legislature for 6 terms. I'm starting my 7th term. And prevailing wage has been discussed probably every single year that I've been there. And it is absolutely true that prevailing wage in Connecticut is higher than any of the surrounding states. I always point out the state of Massachusetts starts prevailing wage at $1 of any municipal or state project. And that's the way it should be. Because we want to make sure that the workers that are working on state and municipal projects are the best workers, the ones that are the best compensated, and that we finish projects that will not have issues when they are all done, meaning that the most qualified person does the job and provides a quality product at the end of the day.
Well, that's an advertisement for my my line of work. I really appreciate that. We're going to take a break and come back on that high note to Senator Kathy Yostin from Sprague, Connecticut. We'll tell the listeners a little bit more about Sprague and Eastern Connecticut, and with Brett Brosder, our man in Washington. Stay tuned.
It's time to wake up with Bill Finch, 203-333-9422. Only on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And welcome back to Wake Up with my guest, Senator Kathy Yostin from Sprague, Connecticut, and Brett Brosder, our man in Washington. Before we go any further, I really have a compelling question for both of you. It's National Pizza Day. Name me your favorite one or two best pizza restaurants. Senator, you go first.
All right. So we have a fabulous place called Manny's Pizza in the Greenville section of Norwich, and they have the best potato pizza.
Ooh. Well, the Irishman's interested. Did you have another one?
I think that that's my favorite. There's always a number, 2, 3, or 4, but Manny's Pizza is my favorite.
And, you know, that's local, but you also have the Mohegan Sun with Frank Pepe's Pizza, the nationally recognized home of the pizza. And, Brett, how about you? What are your favorite pizza joint?
You know, I'm a modern fan, but I would say a runner-up would be Dockside in Milford.
And how about D.C.? Have you discovered any good pizza joints and pizza? You know, maybe if these people in Washington ate a little bit more pizza, drank a little bit more whiskey, we'd be able to get a little bit more done.
I would say Two Amy's is a great pizza spot out here, but, you know, nothing compares to the New Haven style, actually being in New Haven or the surrounding area.
Yeah, we started our show by talking about how lucky we are with the University of Connecticut and Yale and the subbase and the casinos and the wonderful beaches that Connecticut have and the Four Seasons. And we've got about 4 inches of Four Seasons on our driveways, right, Senator?
We do.
And I want to get into the budget. I want to get into the budget. We in an hour-long show, it really goes pretty quickly. But before we do, let's just say a little bit about how much in common Eastern Connecticut has with the cities socioeconomically. Can you give us a little bit of a comparison?
Well, you and I always talk a lot about the demographics of Eastern Connecticut when you were the mayor of Bridgeport, and how alike they were relative to that. Eastern Connecticut has more than 50% of the distressed municipalities. We're very diverse. We have many people that have moved into our area. We have a large Hispanic population in Norwich and a large Haitian population, and have not just for the last year or two, but for the last 20 years. These are things that we rejoice in and we're very proud of. And up and down the 395 corridor, many of our old mill villages have lost those mills as they went out of this country.
Same as the cities. In Torrington, Bridgeport, Willimantic, New Haven, we lost all the mills.
We did. And so this is something that that without recognizing what Eastern Connecticut has, often is not attended to relative to state government.
You know, you and I both are very passionate about protecting the beautiful environment we have in fighting climate change. But we've seen how some of the leaders in Connecticut in the legislature and in our bureaucracy tend to be a little elitist. And we've talked about that. We've talked about not understanding the poverty that people live in our cities and towns. You know, I wonder if you have any observations, both of you, on how the Democratic Party, you know, has always been fighting for the working class, how we can communicate that better to the vast array of citizens who've been hoodwinked into voting for the current president, thinking he's pro-worker. How do we get across to them our message of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, unemployment compensation, all the wonderful tenets of our social democracy that we've created? People seem to be willing to go to someone who's against those and against their own self-interest. How do we get through on that?
Well, I think we have to start talking to people. A lot of times we avoid having those hard discussions, thinking that other people's concerns are to be avoided or ignored. And I really think we have to go back and start talking to people. And I find that that's a missing conduit in letting people know who are really protecting workers' rights, who believe in collective bargaining, and who believe in the rights of a good pension and good health care. Without bringing that forward and without having those discussions and showing people the facts, we're not going to move ahead.
Well, I think those are so wise. Those words are so wise. And all three of us had our roots in municipal government. Senator Osten was the first selectman of Sprague. Brett Brosner was my public information officer when I was mayor of Bridgeport for 8 years. And, you know, I often thought, Senator, that if I had been mayor first, as you were, and then senator, I would have been a better senator. I can remember being in meetings where we wanted to implement a policy or start a program in Bridgeport, and I'd be told, well, you really can't do that. This state law prohibits this, prohibits that. And I would say, well, who would vote for such a stupid thing? And my lawyers would say, well, actually, Senator Finch did. And so, you know, if I had been mayor like you were first, it really helps, doesn't it?
It does. I think it gives you a perspective of what everyday people are going through in their respective municipalities. I started the day out today driving around just because it's something that I've always done ever since I was first selectman, to see how people are faring with this winter storm, making sure that everybody seems to be okay. And I saw people out shoveling or using a snowblower or having their sidewalks plowed or their driveways plowed. And the roads are fantastic in Eastern Connecticut. So we invite everybody to come out and drive slow, but the roads are really good. Our DOT drivers have done a fantastic job, as are local municipalities.
You know, having been a mayor and then also running the New York State Thruway Authority, I have such admiration, respect, and semi-worship for the men and women who get in on those plows in dangerous situations. You know, no one understands how difficult it is for them to do their job. So we do listen. All the people listening in your car, when they say, please stay 300 feet back, you know, 200 at least, please stay back. Don't crowd the plow. Give the men and women who are out there, you know, sweating it out for us to be able to move about freely. We take them for granted. We really shouldn't. Brett, did you have any questions for the senator? I know you are we're going to also want to know what our picks are for Super Bowl. Brett, do you have any questions for the senator?
Yeah, Senator, I would say with, with your amazing district housing the major casino footprint in the state, with the Super Bowl today, just wanted to ask you a little bit about thoughts on sports betting and its proliferation, and just kind of not only the overall landscape there, but the impact it has on the state.
Well, we we really, both sports betting and online gaming are new to Connecticut over the last couple of years. They are an asset to our two federally recognized tribal nations. By the way, it brings sports betting into the sunshine of understanding what's going on. Sports betting has been happening for decades. It was done behind the scenes, and it had no real regulation or controls on it. Now we have regulations, we have controls, we have oversight, and people enjoy it. It is something that people have for years decided how they were going to bet on a sports team. Some people use statistics on the players. Some people use the color of the uniform as their way of picking a player or a team. And I think that this is something that I was pleased to be a part of to bring forward and bring it into the sunlight of looking at this type of gambling.
You know, it reminds me of the time that we tried to get a casino in Bridgeport, and I really do think, with all the downside that people talk about with gambling, we have seen the economic impact, especially for the tribes that had suffered genocide at our hands, and now we've got them back on their feet with a stable means of supporting the tribe and creating a lot of economic opportunity in Eastern Connecticut.
They do. It is very much. Both the Mashantucket Pequots and the Mohegans really care deeply about doing gaming and gambling in a safe manner. They both participate in programs for problem gambling, and they both are supporting their tribal nations and the families that are encompassed within the confines of their tribal nations. They follow the Indian gaming rules. So they not only have state of Connecticut rules, but they have rules that govern their tribal nation and the fact that they have to spend the profits of gaming on increasing their family's stability and moving people forward. If you pay attention to the tribal nations, as I have for a lot of years now, because they're two of our largest businesses in the state of Connecticut. They employ more than 12,000 people in Eastern Connecticut. They are planning for the next seven generations of their families to make sure that they are moving their nations forward. I really am pleased to have both of them. And actually, I'm looking for federal government to recognize the three other state-recognized tribes that we have as federal tribes, which will bring in additional dollars on housing and a number of other things to support those tribal nations and increase the support for their families moving forward.
You know, Kathy, that is so important. You know, the Golden Hill Pawgussets have been decimated by white Europeans, and they hang on and they hang on. The Shattuckokes under Chief Velke, we've gone to school together. Our families know each other. These are people who never, ever, tried to avoid the fact that they were native to this land. They've always been proud of their heritage. It's a wonderful way to take our break and just think about, it's not Thanksgiving, but the Native Americans have meant so much to this country. We're going to be right back after this brief break in the news.
Join the conversation, 203-333-9422. Back to Wake Up with Bill Finch, live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And welcome back to Wake Up here on WICC 600 AM and 95.9 FM. The wonderful voice of Paul Peorick has gotten us through about 25 years of storms and rain and sleet and whatever. Thank you, Paul, for those wonderful predictions. We're talking with State Senator Kathy Osten, and we're joined by Martin Dunleavy, who is very active in state local government all his life and had the wonderfully prestigious position of being political director for the American Federation of Government Employees. And right now we see a president vilifying the service of the several million people in America that work for the federal government, doing all things from, you know, running our national parks to processing income taxes to landing planes safely. And according to our president, these people are to be vilified and gotten rid of and sort of cleared out like Gaza is going to be cleared out. The craziest stuff comes out of this guy's mouth and out of his head. We have no idea where it comes from. But before we get into that in the federal employees, Senator, we really want to just briefly talk about the process of creating a budget. Obviously, the employees for the state of Connecticut are very important to all the things that we spend money on. And Marty, we'll get to you in terms of the federal employee situation in just a minute. But Kath, could you talk to us about how now we have guardrails, thanks to Governor Malloy and Governor Lamont and the legislature, and what the guardrails do? And then we've heard talk about a fund that's created based on the volatility of our taxes. Could you explain that to our listeners, those two principles, and any other principles that are guiding you in the creation of the budget and your role at the legislature?
Sure. Thank you. So what are known as the fiscal guardrails were established in part in 2017 when we had a very long time, years, in fact, of difficult financial circumstances in Connecticut. When Governor Malloy,
we were kicking the can down the road, right?
Exactly. When he first came into office, there was no money in the rainy day fund. That we were borrowing money for operational expenses. So we worked together with the administration to make some real changes. Governor Malloy first said to the legislature, I won't sign a budget unless you're paying the regular normal expenses of the pensions, what we call the ADAC. So that's how we first started this process. A lot of changes were made in our pension systems. We are on Tier 4, what is called Tier 4. All new employees are, when they come on board, are given a hybrid 401k. It is not a normal defined benefit plan. And there were changes made to the contributions of employees. There were changes made to how overtime is calculated into pensions. All of this was done in concert with the unions so that everybody was on board recognizing where we were. The spending cap is a constitutional amendment that was approved by the people in the state of Connecticut. The one part of the guardrails that is can be related to change to address today's issue on how much money we have to support our safety net services, mostly done by our nonprofit environments, but also work that is done within our elementary schools in higher ed, is what we call the volatility cap. Which is money that we receive from the top taxpayers in the state of Connecticut. And for many years was going back and forth, very volatile, hard to predict. That is not the case any longer. The volatility cap is no longer volatile. It's a normal revenue that we get in, and we've been getting in for probably 7 or 8 years. And we expect, and it is planned for that to be ongoing for the next decade. So what we're looking at is making some changes to the volatility cap that will allow more spending to happen for our safety net services, like nonprofits. Safety net services also include birth to three, care for children who have a need, special education services within the confines of our elementary education, and services that are related to forwarding young people an opportunity to get a job when they get out of high school or go to college as their choice may be. So we're working on, and the governor made proposals to change or ameliorate the volatility cap to account for the expenses that we are incurring on a regular basis to support developmental services, homeless services, people with mental health services, those kinds of services that are quite necessary to us existing as a community and benefiting those in need.
You know, we've all been involved in politics for a long time, and we've heard either as elected people or just people working on campaigns, why aren't they doing something about the housing shortage? Why aren't they doing something about creating jobs? Why aren't they doing something about that company pouring garbage into the river? Why aren't they? They is the legislature in Connecticut and the Congress in Washington and the city councils in Norwich and Sprague. They are working hard, and they collect taxes from each of us based loosely on our ability to pay. When it comes to property taxes, it, nobody cares how much you make. They just take your money. And we know how tough that is in Sprague and Bridgeport. But, you know, this is a circle. This is a cycle. We collect taxes. And, you know, editorializing here, Democrats are tax and spend. I would always tell people, you're damn right we're tax and spend. We're not going to tax you if we don't have a good reason to spend it. But we do have good reasons to spend it. Getting kids in early childhood education. Kathy, you know, we found out in Bridgeport that the poor kids that we were trying to get into early childhood education, if they came from bilingual families specifically, they would only have heard by the time they were ready for kindergarten about 1,000 English words. Those who were from wealthier suburbs were hearing 6,000 words by the time they started kindergarten. So early brains that were developing needed to have help to develop properly, and that's when we stepped in and we did spend city tax money and state tax money to get kids into early child education, which we're going to see the benefits of that for the entire length of those children's lives. You know, sometimes it must get frustrating, right?
I think it does get frustrating, but property taxes in Connecticut. First, I want to say Democrats proposed a $600 million tax decrease in the last biennial budget, and are always looking ways to figure out how we can cut the burden on everyday people in Connecticut. So in the last biennial budget, not only did we increase services, we also cut taxes to the $600 million. So that is, something that I think we have to say over and over again, because when people say that Democrats are only looking to increase spending, we want to have spending that is directly for the services necessary for residents in Connecticut. That includes health care, good plowed roads, services to make sure people have a place to live. Those are all things that are necessary for the government to look at. So there are good government expenses that happen, and they revolve around the everyday necessary services that people need. Now, property taxes are the very, very difficult part of local municipalities because they cover education. And in most across the board in the state of Connecticut, education is the most expensive service that property taxes pay for. And a part of that is special education. Special education in Connecticut is very expensive. But the federal government, when they passed IDEA, which is the federal law that requires states and municipalities to cover special education, something I think we should do, is supposed to pay 40% of special education and pays about 6 or 7% right now. So I would be looking at the federal government to forward some dollars that will help us decrease property taxes in every municipality across the board. We're also looking at the state government to cover what is called excess costs. Those costs for the neediest children in the state, we are looking at ways to decrease those costs for municipalities. And I'm hoping that in the next few weeks, we'll be able to roll out some processes that will provide some resources, some financial resources for municipalities, not only in the next biennium, but in this current fiscal year, to have the state take on some of the additional costs in current special education. Right now, we put $181 million in every year as a base for special education. The costs this year are $101 million above that $181 million. And next year and the year after are slated to be above $126 million and $161 million in each year of the biennium. So we are looking at ways to both control the increases of those expenses and still provide children with the necessary services to make sure that they're as productive as they can be.
So we're going to have to take a break here. Those are challenging numbers that you've outlined for us. For every parent out there that has a child who may have some special learning needs, obviously you want to pay close attention to those numbers because that's your child's future there. And for those of us who care about those children who are not ours, who have learning disabilities, then it is incumbent on a state to be compassionate and do the best we can. We're going to have about 10 minutes left when we come back, and we're going to be hearing from Kathy, Senator Austin, and Martin Dunleavy, because as we did, the governor proposed his budget. The big question mark at the end of several of his proposals were, we'll have to wait and see what the crazy man in Washington says. So we're going to take a break and come back and try to prognosticate what crazy looks like in the next 2 years of Connecticut's budget. We'll be right back after this.
Talking about what matters to you this morning. Wake up with Bill Finch. WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And welcome back to myself, Bill Finch, your host of Wake Up every Sunday morning at 10 here on Connoisseur Media, the voice of Connecticut. I'm joined by Senator Kathy Austin and Martin Dunleavy. And, you know, we talked about the state budget. Kathy is right at the tip of the funnel. Senator Austin helped create the budget. She's one of the most influential members in the Capitol. And it's great to know that she has a background of having to be a first selectman slash mayor of a small impoverished town in eastern Connecticut to make her base her decisions on. So we heard the governor give his speech. I thought the speech was pretty good. I was really happy and proud that he was my governor. But Martin, Marty, you heard him say several times, well, this all depends on what Trump's going to do in Washington. And no one in their right mind could predict what this guy's going to do because he's not in his right mind and we are. But he seems pretty devious, and it seems like the federal employees have a big target on their back because we all know they don't work, right? They just show up, collect a paycheck, and go home, and the planes land themselves, and the water cleans themselves, and the parks run themselves. So why do we need federal employees, Marty?
Well, Bill, going back to when the Republicans were into shutting down government under the Clinton administration.
Which they did multiple times.
Multiple times. And I was the political director and part one of the negotiators through that period with both the Republicans and the White House. Government works best when it's invisible. And what I mean by that is if your trash is picked up, if the water is clean, if the mail is delivered, if the streets are relatively safe, if your Social Security check arrives on time, then people don't appreciate government. But they do appreciate it when services they want and use are taken away from them. And it is always an overreach when enemies of public employees and public services curtail services without a real public dialogue on what's going to happen and when and how it's going to happen. This draconian slash and burn first few weeks of the Trump administration, and particularly having a multi-billionaire who has no government background and has no...
Well, he has a lot of contracts from the government. He makes a lot of money off the United States government.
He does, but this is a man who has no responsibility to the taxpayers, to the legislature. He's never gone through a federal background check for the work he's doing. And for that very reason, this is all going to be overturned by the courts. Even a very friendly Supreme Court is going to say, you might be able to do all of these things that you want to do, but the legislature has passed a budget. Congress and the Senate have appropriated funds, and you can't arbitrarily stop spending that money. You can go into the budget process and zero out those lines. In the meantime, a lot of federal employees, but most importantly, their families are going to be hurt severely. They're not going to have money for food, for rent, for mortgage, for car payments, for clothes. You know, I mean, it's if they start laying off people willy-nilly. Now, the courts, the lower courts have been very good in that they basically put
them.
A stay on every single thing that that the administration has done so far. I believe, and in talking to friends of mine still at AFGE who are intimately involved in this, including the deputy chief legal counsel of the union and the president of the union, they're pretty confident they're going to win all these cases in court. Even with this Supreme Court, they believe that it will be ruled unconstitutional what Doge and the Trump administration and Musk is doing. They're also absolutely 100% confident that that the Doge employee, quote-unquote employees under Musk, are violating several federal laws.
Well, how about there's just the fact they don't have security clearances. Ironically, the members of Congress who have security clearance were locked out of federal offices while little hooded Muskites went in and, without security clearance, accessed everyone's data. I mean,
well, that's what I was going to say. There is no doubt about it that federal laws have been broken, both individually and collectively, on the mining of personal data. And that's going to have repercussions. But that may take a year or two or longer to play out through the court system.
And all this crap's going to blow back on local towns and states.
Well, not only that, it's going to blow back on Americans who all of a sudden have their personal data floating in the wind.
Yeah.
You know, they've got some 19-year-old kid from Greenwich, you know, playing around with their personal data.
It's crazy. And people like Senator Rosten now have to juggle a budget that in normal times there was a dependent voice in Washington that you may disagree with, but there were social norms, there was norms of respect, there were norms of bipartisanship, the balance of power between the branches of government, the peaceful transfer of power. But with this treasonous president, we now see that the peaceful transfer of power is debatable, the balance of power between the branches is debatable. Now, people are talking about his Supreme Court ruling where he can't be arrested while he's in office, but there were three things they ruled on, and they only ruled that one of the ways that he broke the law could not be prosecuted, as I understand it. But there still are other ways that the Supreme Court may allow him to be prosecuted. Certainly, as you said, he's done illegal things, and you know, hopefully the laws will stop him. But, Senator, we're going to have to wrap up in a few moments. Tell the listeners what you're worried about in terms of the sort of capriciousness and irrationality that's coming out of Washington money-wise, and what that might mean to Connecticut and Sprague and Bridgeport taxpayers.
So I am worried about this. I'm worried about the fact that it is not the, just like in Connecticut, the governor presents a budget, but it is the legislature who approves the budget. In Congress, the president presents a budget, but it is Congress who approves the funding, and it is Congress who holds the purse strings in any budget. And to ignore Congress and to have Congress not stand up for their they're supposed to stand up and say, no, that is not your responsibility. That is ours, because they are directly reflective of what people in the United States want, just like the legislature is more directly reflective of what the people want, because we actually interface directly with the people. That is not true of the president in regards to the federal budget, and is not true of the state in regards to the governor. He works with his administrators. We work directly with the people. That's true in Congress. The president doesn't work directly with the people. Congress does, and Congress has a responsibility that they need to stand up for, not because it's not only because it's the right thing to do, it's the constitutional thing to do, and we should be abiding by the Constitution and making sure that Congress is standing up to support everyday people in this country across the board.
You know, it's funny, the anger president, as I refer to him, he's so angry and he's made his followers so angry that some of them don't care about the Constitution. And that's the thing that scares me the most.
Bill, they've never even read the Constitution. They don't know what's in it.
Yeah.
We can brag all we want about STEM, but one of the real dangers is we do not have civics in the school. We don't talk or teach people about government. So therefore, they believe any lie that comes at them.
Well, I don't want to end on a down note. We're going to fight like hell, right, Senator? Right, Marty, to change this? But I want to thank you
Absolutely.
Both for being my guests here on another episode of Wake Up on Connoisseur Media. We'll see you back here next week when Vic Woodard is going to preview a banned book called Gender Queer, and I'm looking forward to that. We don't ban books in Connecticut. We shouldn't ban them anywhere. Thank you for listening.